This week's parsha is Parshat Lech Lecha. We're here Tuesday morning at Akiva for our weekly parsha class in the framework of JSI. It's November 1st. We're focusing on the relationship between Avram and Sarah as it plays itself out with the addition of a third, which is Hagar. We have to look at some background to really understand what's going on. The order of study will be as follows. First, to look at the main set of verses we're interested in for today. Just a quick read through. And then going backwards to all the background, which we'll go through slowly. And then back to today's verses, reading them verse by verse and word by word. And these sheets give all the instructions and materials. So we're in chapter 16 of Bereishit. Chapter 16, verses 1 to 6. 16, 1 to 6. And for Jane, here is a sheet. Good morning.
Good morning, Jane.
Everyone have the place? Okay. Chapter 16. Sarai, Avram's wife, had borne him no children. She had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said to Avram, "Look, the Lord has kept me from bearing. Consort with my maid, perhaps I shall have a son through her." And Avram heeded Sarai's request. So Sarai, Avram's wife, took her maid, Hagar the Egyptian, after Avram had dwelt in the land of Canaan 10 years, and gave her to her husband Avram as concubine. He cohabited with Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was lowered in her esteem. And Sarai said to Avram, "The wrong done me is your fault. I myself put my meat in your bosom. Now that she sees that she is pregnant, I am lowered in her esteem. The Lord decide between you and me." Avram said to Sarai, "Your maid is in your hands. Deal with her as you think right." Then Sarai treated her harshly, and she ran away from her. That's the material. And there's a lot there below the surface, a lot to understand and perhaps that cannot be understood. Like I said, we're going to go back now and look at some background to come back to these verses and read them word by word and verse by verse. Going to chapter 11, verse 10, right, which is back to Parshat Noah. Chapter 11, verse 10. Everyone have the place? Back to 11. And I'm going to read something that seems to have no meaning and certainly no relevance that we're doing right now, but it will connect. Chapter 11, verse 10. This is the line of Shem, who of course was the son, one of three sons of Noah. Shem was 100 years old when he begot Arpachshad 2 years after the flood. After the birth of Arpachshad, Shem lived 500 years, begot sons and daughters. When Arpachshad had lived 35 years, he begot Shelach. After the birth of Shelach, Arpachshad lived 403 years and begot sons and daughters. When Shelach lived 30 years, he begot Eber. After the birth of Eber, Shelach lived 403 years, begot sons and daughters. When Eber lived 34 years, he begot Peleg. After the birth of Peleg, Eber lived 430 years and begot sons and daughters. When Peleg had lived 30 years, he begot Reu. After the birth of Reu, Peleg lived 209 years, begot sons and daughters. When Reu had lived 32 years, he begot Serug. After the birth of Serug, Serug lived 27 years, begot sons and daughters. When Serug lived 30 years, he begot Nahor. After the birth of Nahor, Serug lived 200 years, begot sons and daughters. When Nahor lived 29 years, he begot Terach. After the birth of Terach, Nahor lived 119 years, begot sons and daughters. When Terach lived 70 years, he begot Avram, Nahor, and Haran. And the point is that the father of Terach, and the grandfather, and the great grandfather, and the great great grandfather, and the great great, and the great great great, and the great 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 great, and great 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 great, they all had children at the age of 35, or 34, or 32, or 30, or 29. And for Terach, it took until age 70.
He's slow at begetting.
And we wonder why that happened. And of course, one very plausible possibility is barrenness. He was married for 40 years, perhaps more, according to, if everyone gets married about the age of 29, 28, 30, 31, he's been married 40 years until he and his wife have their first child.
So So what do you think the reason is?
We don't know, but we could start thinking what that does to a marriage, what it does to a relationship between husband and wife, and of course, how they feel when and if a child is born. Let's go on. Now this is the line of Terach. Terach begat Avram, Nahor and Haran. And Haran begat Lot. Haran died in the lifetime of his father Terach in his native land, or of the Chaldeans. So Terach and Mrs. Terach not only suffered perhaps infertility with all the pain and the suffering and the sense of lack of self-worth that goes along with that. Finally, three children are born, and one of them dies in childhood. Tragedy on the back of tragedy. Avram and Nahor, the two remaining children of Terach and Mrs. Terach, took to themselves wives, the name of Avram's wife being Sarai, and that of Nahor's wife being Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and Iscah. Now Sarai was barren, she had no children. So this pattern seems to repeat itself. Avram and Sarai have no children, just like Avram's parents had no children for many, many years. And the tragedy repeats itself with the suffering and with the tensions, perhaps the mutual recrimination or resentment between husband and wife, the questions of if this a proper match, perhaps we should get divorced, perhaps Avram should search for another wife. And as the years go by and Avram sees his pattern of life repeated when it came from his parents, again you wonder what's going on there, and you just have to think of all the pain and all the suffering. Okay. Let's go on. The life of Avraham continues in chapter 12. I'm going to read verses 1, 2, 4, 5, and 7. I'm following the sheets as usual. The Lord said to Avram, "Go forth from your native land and from your father's house to the land that I will show you. I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you. I'll make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I'll bless those who bless you and curse him that curses you, and all the families of the earth shall be bless themselves by you." So Avram went forth as the Lord had commanded him, and Lot went with him. Avram was 75 years old when he left Haran. By the way, his wife was 10 years younger, 65. And after reading those verses, we'll read also verse 5 and then 7. Avram took his wife Sarai and his brother's son Lot, and all the wealth that they had amassed, and the persons they had acquired in Haran, they set forth for the land of Canaan. Okay, and then we'll read verse 7. The Lord appeared to Avram and said, "I will assign this land to your offspring." There are no offspring. Right? He's going to be a great nation, says God. You will be a blessing to all the families of the earth. Your offspring will receive this land, and there is no offspring. So not only do Avram and Sarai, I assume, suffer. Everyone else has children. That's the foundation of the culture. There's hope, of course, for continuing the line. All the pain of not being part of that, but God just rubs it in. Because God says, look what I'm going to give to your children. There'll be so many children. For generations, you'll be a blessing to the world, and there are no children. No children at all.
Cruel joke. Yeah.
Or a promise.
It's a promise. Of course it's a promise. But at the same time it's a promise, it's also really painful.
Yeah, yeah.
He's 75.
Yeah, not a young man. Again, we're emphasizing that all of his contemporaries, they had children at the age of 29, 30, 31, 34. For nine generations it was like that. Okay, let's go on even further. Just one thing I have to emphasize, that Avram was 75 years old. We already read that his father had children at the age of 70. That's five more years. And you can just imagine that Avram is 35 and he's got married and he's expecting to have children, and they don't come for a decade and two decades and three decades, and he's wondering if he's going to suffer as much as his parents suffered. And he does, and then even more. And every year that goes by after the age of 70, he's looking at the clock. Okay, further on.
Rabbi, was this one of the tests that Abraham went through? I think there were 10 tests he went
through. The Midrash lists 10 tests, and many of the Midrashim do not say what they were.
Is there anywhere that lists the 10? But we certainly know the binding of Yitzhak.
Right, it's one of them.
The
There are Midrashim that list the 10, and it's not always clear what they're referring to. Is this in any of the lists? I think it is, but I'm not sure. Again, most of them don't have any content. Yesterday there were 10 tests. Mm-hmm. It's only a later Midrash. I think it's Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer. I take it back. That's not a later Midrash. There must have been an oral traditions of what the 10 tests were. And then, actually, the Rishonim, the middle of commentators, some of them have arguments what the 10 tests were. It's just like 613 mitzvot. The Talmud says that 613 doesn't say what they are. And then the later authorities try and figure out what they are. And each has a different approach. What exactly are the 613? But this is certainly, from the simple flow of the text, this is one of the major challengers, tests of Avram and Sarah.
What does it test? Faith?
Well, to make a long story short, it's not our subject today. A test is not
no,
to see the result.
What is a test? What does it, this specific thing test?
Is faith?
Well, let's use a different word than test. What does the test inculcate? What does it steal you? What does it do to your personality? Hmm. So it really brings us back to what Liz is saying, a certain dependence and reliance on God.
But it's
a good question. I never thought it about in those terms. I don't want to take too much time. There's something else we have to do. But it could be, it really could be that it's not the right question to ask. Although I'm not sure because I never asked that question. I've always just said to myself, and I've said to my students, that a test, difficulties, challenges build us, steal us, make us more sensitive, make us more self-reliant, make us more resilient.
It is so much more fun not to have to be so resilient and self-reliant.
It's certainly easier.
Yeah, but it's less mature and it's a less textured life.
But what is a test?
So perhaps that's the wrong question. Yeah. It doesn't test anything. It just makes you stronger.
So it's an opportunity for growth.
It's a character builder.
Yeah.
Yeah, but when disaster hits you, you're not so rejoicing for your growth.
Not at the moment.
Right.
Not later.
Okay, let's go on. Let's go on, although I admit it's something to think about.
Yeah.
The story of Avram and Sarai goes on. We're just going to read some verses from chapter 13, 11 and 14. 13, 11 and 14. Chapter 13, verse 11 says, "So Lot chose for himself the whole plain of the Jordan, and Lot journeyed eastward. Thus they parted from each other. Avram remained in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled in the cities of the plain."
So Lot got the Jordan.
He got the Jordan Valley.
Yeah.
Stone, Amorah.
Ah, okay.
And Avram gets the hill country. The point for our purposes here is that if Avram was 75 when he left his homeland with his wife, they have no children, they're promised great offspring by God, they have a member of the younger generation in their entourage, they have Lot. As long as Lot is there, Avram and Sarai are not completely alone. And they have hope for the future. Perhaps Lot will be their inheritor. Lot leaves. I want to see that in the framework of the psychological, the emotional relationship between Avram and Sarah and God. Now they're really alone. Now they're even more dependent on the future that will come forth from her womb. And if it doesn't come, they're alone, they're lonely.
How much younger is Lot?
He's the nephew, so he's a whole generation younger. It could be 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. And then verse 14. "And the Lord said to Avram, after Lot had parted from him," it's important, "after, raise your eyes and look out from where you are, to the north and south, to the east and the west. For I give all the land that you see to you and your offspring forever. I'll make your offspring as the dust of the earth, so that if one can count the dust of the earth, then your offspring too can be counted. So it's important that God spoke this after Lot had parted from him. And it might be a time of tremendous despondency of Abraham, because Lot is gone, the last hope is gone. And then God says, hope has not even begun. There'll be many, many, many children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Okay, let's go on further. We're going now to 15, chapter 15. The beginning of chapter 15. Sometime later, the word of the Lord came to Avram in a vision. He said, fear not, Avram. I am a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great. But Avram said, O Lord God, what can you give me, seeing that I shall die childless? And the one in charge of my household is domestic Eliezer. Avram said further, since you have granted me no offspring, my steward will be my heir. Avram seems to be completely lost faith. Time is marching on. His wife is getting older. And there's no children, despite the divine promise. The word of the Lord came to him in reply, that one shall not be your heir. None but your own issue shall be your heir. He took him outside and said, look toward the heaven and count the stars if you're able to count them. And he added, so shall your offspring be. Because he put his trust in the Lord, he reckoned it to his merit. This drama of getting older, no children, God's promise, getting older, no children, God's promise, Lot leaving, getting older, no children, God's promise. That's really the central thread that keeps the whole narrative of the stories together. That's really what it's all about. It's all about seeing how God is stringing Avram along and Sarah, and they're getting older, and it's getting ridiculous. The tension between reality and the promise is getting greater and greater.
And I think Sarah has a harder time because he's at least a bit encouraging of Avraham from time to time, but Sarah gets nothing.
No, we don't know. We don't hear anything.
Well, we have to
we don't have anything.
What we have.
And she might be wondering, is the promise to be fulfilled through me or not through me?
Yes, exactly. Especially since Hagar becomes pregnant.
Well, we're about to get to that. Right. And I just want to say one more thing, which is the following. In general in life, we all have disappointments and hopes and dreams that are not fulfilled. And as decades go by, some people learn to reconcile themselves to dreams that won't be fulfilled. But God is preventing Avraham from reconciling himself with barrenness. Because as long as hope still exists, you can't accommodate yourself to it. Right? In many areas, psychologists say that hope is a very dangerous thing. It keeps you going. Keeps you going and doesn't allow you to live where you really are. It doesn't allow you to live in reality.
You live with future instead of where you are.
So just as Avram and Sarai are about to accommodate themselves to the reality and accept it and live with it and go on, God comes and says, no, not so fast. Keep dreaming and keep hoping, which means keep suffering.
Wow.
Keep suffering, right? Okay.
What is the truth in suffering if God is promising you to fulfill, you know, the desire of your heart?
And how do you know that He will?
I'm talking about psychological suffering.
The reality and the hope is just getting greater and greater and greater.
Yes.
I'm making a fundamental assumption. Avram and Sarah are humans like I know humans, right? If you don't accept that, and many traditional Jews don't accept that assumption, but I think the verses bear it out. I mean, the verse we just read said that Avram said to God, you've granted me no offspring. I'm going to die childless. It's not like Avraham is a superhuman man of faith that never has any doubts. It's right there in the text.
I mean, he took Sarah offered Hagar and Abraham. Avram took Hagar.
Yeah. Yes.
So
with no hesitation.
We'll see if there's no hesitation. Let's go to bed right now. Right, back to chapter 16. So now we've gone through A in the sheets, A1, now we're in 2. Now we're in 2, chapter 16, verses 1 to 6. Sarai, Avram's wife, had borne him no children. So first I want to emphasize that we as the reader know everything that's just we just told. The verse could have said Sarai, etc. Avram's wife, we know she's Avram's wife. We know she bore him no children. But the verse is emphasizing, number one, relationships between Avram and Sarai, and emphasizing the subject of this particular chapter, that she bore him no children. She had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said to Avram, look, the Lord has kept me from bearing. So she blames herself. There's no concept here of male impotence. It's all her fault.
It's the Lord's fault. Look, the Lord has kept me from bearing.
Yeah, but it's kept me.
True.
So why is he keeping me from bearing? What did I do wrong? Consort with my maid. Perhaps I shall have a son through her. So I want to point out that the word maid in Hebrew, it's a shifcha, it's an ama, it's a slave girl. And
nobody asks her.
No one asks her. Perhaps I shall have a son through her. The Hebrew is ebane mimena. I will be built up through her. Now notice the Hebrew word for built up and the Hebrew word for son.
Ben.
They're not the same root, but they come from the same root. Bet nun, ben, son, and the word binyan, building. It's the same thing. And it makes sense that it does, because to have a son is to be built up, is to be continued. The building of the family is continued one generation after the other, one layer of bricks after the other. And what Sarai says to Abraham is, perhaps I shall be sonned through her. I will be built through her. It's the same, again, the same word.
This translation said child.
I will be...
child. They made child into a verb.
I
will be childed. That's what it is. Now let's just point out that in a legal sense, I've seen articles mentioning Mesopotamian law and custom. Indeed, a woman can designate another woman as a surrogate mother. And that mother bears the child of the husband of the mistress, and the child is accounted to the family of the mistress.
We see it later with Rivka and Rachel.
Wait, the family
with Rachel and Leah.
Yeah. The same family thing.
Of the mistress or the family of the wife? Family of
when
the
I
wife.
Said mistress, I meant master. I was using the word mistress in the sense of master, the head,
Mrs.
the missus of the house, the queen. And of course, in a certain sense, we have the exact same thing today.
Yeah,
surrogate motherhood on different levels. And things haven't changed that much, and the emotions behind it certainly haven't changed at all.
Either.
Perhaps I shall have a son through her. And Avram heeded Sarah's request. Now those words, and Avram heeded Sarah's request, in Hebrew, Vishma Avram lechol Sarah. Vishma Avram lechol Sarai. Sarai, excuse me. Avram literally, Avram heard to the voice of Sarai. And it means he obeyed, he acquiesced, he accepted. To hear to a voice is to accept it. But it doesn't say that Avram said any words. Well, he probably did say some words, but it doesn't say that he said words. We'll see that it's going to be significant. And you wonder how many words he said. He didn't say a full sentence. That would have been recorded. He nodded. He said, okay. He said, whatever you want. And that's all, perhaps. Now, I want to skip for a second to verse 4.
The important thing is he didn't say no.
He certainly didn't say no. That's clear.
It was a gesture of a lack of faith on both of their part in the fulfillment of God's promise.
Or it's just a reinterpretation of his promise.
Right. That's a very interesting tension. Now, is what they did, is it good or is it bad? Is it a lack of faith? Or is it actually accepting God's promise and trying to fulfill it? Right? Because you also might say that sexual intimacy is a lack of faith. Just wait for God to bring children.
Good for you.
That would be utterly irrational. Children
So why is it irrational to have sexual intimacy with a woman who's fertile?
I just found in pumpkin patches it requires, you know, conception by a woman.
Okay, so it's not working between Avram and Sarai, so try it with another woman.
Okay.
It's, what you said, Tony, is a very plausible reaction to the text, but it's not the only reaction.
Mm-hmm.
Because what Adam said is just as rational, perhaps even more rational. You know the story about the helicopter and the flood?
Yes. Mm-hmm. God will help.
No, there's a flood and someone on the top of a building and a helicopter comes and he says, I'm not taking the helicopter, I'm waiting for God. And he drowns. God asks him after he dies, why didn't you take my helicopter? I sent you salvation, you didn't take it. Anyway.
But it's interesting because all the promises that have been given have been to Abraham.
Right. It never says who's the woman going to be. Yeah.
Hmm.
So let's read on. So are we saying that it says in the end of verse 2, and Avram heeded Sarai's request? Then it says in 3, so Sarai. And by the way, the word so is not there in Hebrew. It just says Sarai, beginning of 3. Sarai, Avram's wife, took her maid, Hagar the Egyptian, after Avram had dwelt in the land of Canaan 10 years, and gave her to her husband Avram's concubine. I'll come back to that. He cohabited with Hagar, etc. Now I want to ask something. At the end of verse 2, when it says, Avram heeded Sarai's request, well, if he heeded her request, the sense of he agreed, he acquiesced, what would be the next step? Obviously, the next step would be to do it.
Right.
Would be verse 4. In other words, verse 3 is unnecessary, superfluous, and out of place. It should have read from the end of 2 to 4. And Avram heeded Sarai's request. He cohabited with Hagar. Fine. Why did he verse 3?
Because
wait a second. I just want to say a few more things. Sorry about that. Therefore, I'm going to suggest verse 3 is superfluous. And I'm going to make another point in verse 3 before we open this up. In verse 3, look at the words that the English translation, at least mine, puts within hyphen. It's hyphenated. After Avram had dwelt in the land of Canaan 10 years. See those words?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, in Hebrew there's no hyphens, but the English translation, I understand why it put those words there, because they really seem to interrupt a larger thought. The thought is that Sarai took the maid and gave her to Avram. In the middle of that thought, it said, after Avram had dwelt in the land of Canaan 10 years. Now those words, after Avram had dwelt in the land of Canaan 10 years, those words really belong someplace else. I would have put them at the beginning of the story. I would say, after Avram had dwelt in the land of Canaan 10 years, then, verse 1, Sarai, Avram's wife, had borne him no children, an Egyptian maidservant named Hagar. Sarai said to Avram, look, if those words tell us when the whole story took place, they should be at the beginning. But they're not at the beginning. They're in the middle of a sentence. And therefore, they lead me to the conclusion that perhaps those words, after Avram had dwelt in the land of Canaan 10 years, do not describe the background of the whole story. They just describe the background of verse 3.
So he waited 10 years before she finally forced him.
Yeah. That's my suggestion. Look at it again. End of verse 2.
What did you say, Adam? Say it again.
That he waited 10 years and then finally Sarah took her maidservant and forced him to.
But it says, Vayishmavam kol Sarai before.
Yes, it says at the end of verse 2, and Avram heeded Sarai's request, which means again, he agreed. And what did he do?
Nothing.
Nothing.
10 years.
Nothing. He did nothing.
Just common for husbands to do with their wives.
Not in his head.
And I'm not saying that's bad, I'm not saying it's good.
Oh.
But think of the predicament in which poor Avraham faces.
And Sarah.
His wife, and he really wants children, really, really, really want children, and God really wants them to have children. And it seems like they're not going to have children. Time is going on. The biological clock is ticking. The years are marching by. And finally, in a tremendous act of self-sacrifice, Sarai says to herself, perhaps it's not going to be through me. I'll give to Avraham Hagar, and she'll be a surrogate mother and a surrogate womb. And she really means it, but Avram knows a little bit that if they get into this love triangle, there's going to be explosion in the household. he cannot disagree with his wife's suggestion, but he also cannot
agree.
Actually carry it out. He agrees and does nothing.
He's an unwilling polygamist.
And the years go on until literally Sarai takes Hagar, almost literally, takes her and forces a situation. She picks up the woman or says to the woman, you go to Avram's tent, because Avram is not going to her tent.
Well, she's really suffering. I mean, she's...
Sarai.
Just out of her mind.
And Avram knows a little bit she's going to suffer even more if this experiment
succeeds.
She'll suffer if it fails, she'll suffer if it succeeds.
You know, there's something else in that phrase. It reminds me a lot of the beginning of the Akedah. All these details are kind of adding salt to the wound.
So, let me just say, in Hebrew we say which is the following. In traditional study, when someone works hard and thinks about the text and comes up with a new interpretation, that interpretation turns out to have been said by great thinkers beforehand, well, that's a great source of joy and merit. I managed to think of something that's already been said. So Ilana, without knowing it, is referring to a very, very important article written by today the patriarch of biblical interpretation in Israel. His name is Professor Uriel Simon. He's in his 80s, I think. He taught at Bar-Ilan for many years. He's the son of a very famous German Jewish philosopher going back to the beginning of the 20th century, Professor Ernst Simon. And Uriel Simon wrote an article, a famous article, that's called Akedat Yishmael.
Wow.
Akedat Yishmael, in which he points out all of the literary parallels between what we're reading here and chapter 21, which talks about Abram banishing Yishmael into the desert, where he almost dies. The parallels between that and Akedat Yitzchak.
Wow.
In which really have a dual Akedah, in which Avram almost sacrifices both of his sons at different times. And I'll just add, since we've celebrated Rosh Hashanah only a month ago, that this is a way of explaining the Torah reading on Rosh Hashanah. On Rosh Hashanah, there are two Torah readings, 2 days. One is the story of the banishment of Yishmael, the other is the story of Akedat Yitzchak. And Uriel Simon says that we read them both because there are two Akedot. And what we're being told, among other things, is that God saves Yishmael just as God saves Yitzhak. Mm. And that God is, as it were, telling us through the Torah reading on this day of the universal perspective in Judaism, that God is as much concerned for Yishmael as he has for Yitzhak.
Hold
another can of kosher worms here.
Do you think this is the reason that... the Muslims have the Akedah being done by Ishmael instead of Isaac?
Yes.
I wouldn't say it's the reason, but it's certainly...
Yeah.
I don't know, but...
I mean, there's an idea that Muhammad studied, and a lot of the Quran is actually midrashes that they've sort of... Yeah. So I wonder if there's some sort of connection.
I'm sure it's connected. I don't know enough to say how it's connected. So, back to where we were. The one more thing we have to say about verse 3, which Ilana is pointing at, is that the verse is full of words that are superfluous if you're thinking only of the physical plot. Verse 3 says Sarai and adds Avram's wife. Superfluous, we know that. Took her maid Hagar the Egyptian. We know that Hagar is her maid. You told me in the previous verse. And gave her to her husband Avram. We know that Avram is her husband. The verse is emphasizing the relationships to show us how this act is completely throwing up in topsy-turvy all those family relationships.
Also, the Egyptian is meaningful.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's slowing it down, too. It's really excruciatingly...
Yeah.
And pour salt on for everything.
Yeah.
So I just want to say that Sarai, Avram's wife, is no longer going to be the sole wife. And Hagar, the maid, is no longer going to be just a maid. And Abraham, the husband, is no longer going to be just a husband. Everything becomes so much more complicated. And furthermore, it says in the English translation, at least mine, as concubine. The Hebrew doesn't say this. Hebrew says as a wife.
So it's not really superfluous, it's emphatic. It's there to emphasize very, you know, strongly the point of what it is that they were doing.
Turning everything upside down.
And it's kind of a crescendo towards the end. And she gave it to Abraham, and in Hebrew it's so kind of Isha lo leisha, her husband, for him to a wife. She kind of gave away her rights.
Right.
But certainly polygamy is not frowned upon in these days. Everyone seemed to be doing it. I mean, their kids and grandkids were doing it. Well,
I gave a class a few months
ago
in which I tried to show that the Torah doesn't have a very positive view of the Torah, and the whole Tanakh doesn't have a very positive view of polygamy. But certainly it is accepted in these times. That's true.
I have worked in a Yemenite village in Israel as a volunteer, where there was still polygamy from women that came from Yemen.
Really?
And I have seen suffering, the likes of which I couldn't even imagine.
Really? Mm.
The suffering is unbelievable. Incredible.
Wow.
I never thought I'd meet in my life someone actually...
It is unbelievable, and so much politics. One is trying to manipulate her supremacy over the other, and they use everything, a retarded child, anything, to gain a little bit edge.
Yeah.
That's not healthy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Verse 4. He cohabitated with Hagar, and she conceived. Look how the Torah conserves words. Cohabitated and conceived. It was so simple. First time. Didn't take a year. Didn't take 10 years. Didn't take 20, 30, 40.
Like teenagers.
Yeah. And of course,
it's not a teenager.
The quicker it happens, the greater the humiliation and the pain of Sarai, even though it was all her idea. But that doesn't matter. And when she, meaning Hagar, saw that she had conceived, when Hagar experienced the fact that she conceived, that her tummy is growing, that everyone is noticing that she has life within her, her mistress was lowered in her esteem. Because, I mean, even if she's a very, very ethical woman, but still, she accomplished in 5 minutes what Sarai couldn't accomplish in 40 years. And she's going to be the bearer of the future of the Jewish people for Abraham. She's a great woman. And Sarai... what is she? She's just an old maid.
Mm-hmm.
Just an old maid. And it's really painful. And it's terrible.
Why the contrast between the original, her idea, she would bear a son to her, and now the conception, and she is so upset about it. So it doesn't explain why she's the one that initiated this, and then it happened.
Because it's not her son anymore. It's Hagar's son.
But the reality of it is different. She was trapped.
She thought it would be her son, but suddenly she realizes it's Hagar's son, it's not hers at all.
Right, it's the contrast between the rationality of it and the emotionality of it. It's exactly what she wanted, and it's the worst thing in the world for her. It's the best thing and the worst thing.
She never treats Ishmael like her son.
She's apparently not able, right, to treat Ishmael as her son, even though she thought she would.
There was, 12, 13 years before Isaac was born?
Mm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Approximately that, between 12 and 15 years difference, yeah.
Ishmael was her chattel, as opposed to her son. Hagar was her, you know, this was chattel slavery. Hagar was her slave. And in her mind, she thought that she could take a slave boy born to her slave, and by virtue of the fact that he was her property, she would have all of these bonding emotions.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, you know, apparently she felt nothing of the kind. She just got to view him as a slave.
That could very well
that
be.
That's interesting, yeah.
And just think of one more thing. Think of what happens when Hagar becomes pregnant. She becomes a little bit weaker.
Yes.
She has to eat more. She has some morning sickness. She has to...
she needs to rest.
She needs to rest. Mm-hmm. And who does she ask for a day off? She has to ask Sarai. And then who has to pick up the slack of the tasks that Hagar can't do?
Oh,
Sarai.
So she becomes a slave.
Mm-hmm. Role reversal.
Like a slave to her own hope for children. And that, of course, is the background to verse 6. And Sarai said to Abram, "The wrong done me is your fault. I myself put my maid in your bosom. Now that she sees that she's pregnant, I'm lowered in her esteem. The Lord decide between you and me." So I don't know who is worse off, Sarai or Abram. Sarai is just a bundle. She's a wreck of conflicting emotions. She's in just a heap of tears falling apart. And poor Abraham. What does a man say, right? When his wife says, "It's your fault. But you told me to do it. He did exactly what you asked."
And he waited 10 years to do it.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah. So Abraham has nothing to say.
He still agreed to have a relationship with another woman in a way.
Yeah, he agreed. Because he thought he was doing what his wife wanted.
It's not like he had an affair when he was 20, or 30, or 40, or 50, or 60. He was 85.
Yes. Mm-hmm. He was at least 85.
And it was and when you said with the purpose in mind. It wasn't right. Like he fell in love with the slave girl.
I mean, I agree, it doesn't matter whether you're 22 and just married, or 32 and married for 10 years, but 85.
But with the economy of language, like you said, it sounded like he just came in, did what he was supposed to do, and that was it.
Yeah.
So, and now, in light of that, I'd like to bring up the following thoughts. Abraham and Sarai had a problem, a terrible problem. And Sarai had a possible solution. And Abraham ultimately responded to her solution with acts, and not with words. And we wonder, perhaps, if Avram made a mistake.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He made a mistake, perhaps, in doing what his wife asked.
Yes.
Because not always should husbands do what their wives ask. Because not always the people who ask really want what they ask for.
And he never said, like other men in the Tanakh, "You are more important to me than 10 sons."
Ah. Right.
Or Hannah. He never said, "Are you sure this is a good idea? Maybe we ought to think about this before I do it."
Right.
"Are you sure you want me to kill my only son?"
Yeah.
You don't have to behave towards your wife like you behave towards God.
So if he had a relationship with God, why didn't he go to God in prayer and say, "Look, my wife Sarah is telling me to, you know, do this hideous thing, to take a slave girl against her will or without even consulting her and use her to bear children. Is this your will?" You know, God could have told her, "No, don't do that. Be patient."
You are kind of facing a simplistic relationship. It's not like your next door neighbor.
But prayer, it doesn't presuppose simplicity. Prayer means that you humbly ask God for guidance. You ask God for instruction. Yeah. He always had that option.
So obviously I don't know the answer. But I can point something out. That from the flow of the text, and of course we only read a verse here and a verse there. If you read the flow of this parsha and the next parsha, it looks to me, perhaps I'm imposing my own perceptions on the text, it looks like here is Abraham and Sarai in Mesopotamia. God told them to go to this land, they go. And then they're alone. It's not like God is talking to Abraham every Tuesday and Thursday.
Right.
Once every 15 years, he hears a voice. Mm. And then the line goes dead.
And it's not a two-way street.
And how do you live your life when you have that promise that was spoken 10 years ago or 20 years ago and 30 years ago, and reality seems to fly in the face of the promise? And it's not like there's a calling card to God. We'd like it to be different.
But it is really interesting when you say, "You know, are you sure you want me to kill my only son, my only son, my only son?" You know, Abraham didn't say that, and nor does he say to Sarah, "Are you sure?"
Yeah, but he sure spoke up with Sodom
yes.
and Gomorrah.
Yes.
Right.
I mean,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I was questioning, why did he go to bat for those guys and not his own son?
And or this idea, this half-baked idea.
So I want to put aside, it's a whole other can of kosher worms, an important can of kosher worms, the difference between Abraham's reaction to the Akedah and Abraham's reaction to Sodom and Gomorrah. But just looking at this, notice that we pointed out at the end of verse 2, when it says that Abraham heeded Sarai's request, it doesn't say he said anything. He just heeded the request. Perhaps he nodded, perhaps he said half a sentence.
I hear you, yeah.
He didn't have anything to say.
He should have.
From a male perspective, what do you say to a woman who's asking for hell? She's asking for hell. If she gets it, it's hell. If she doesn't get it, it's also hell.
You say that.
Say it again?
You should say that.
And he should have said
how much. You say that. You say, this is impossible. I can hear my husband saying, wait a minute, this is lose-lose.
In other words, what we're saying is that among other things, this is a story of miscommunication or lack of communication
right.
between men and women.
Same with their son and the next wife, with Yaakov and Esau. That whole thing is a big
yes.
Big mess like, did they ever talk to each
yeah.
other?
It's, to me, it's always very important that people notice something that most people don't notice is that the stories of the Book of Genesis are primarily stories of family dysfunctionality,
yes.
and a lot of it is based upon lack of communication between men and women.
Sarai was a matriarch. Probably wouldn't have taken no for an answer either.
Well, she wasn't a matriarch here. She
wasn't a matriarch.
Yeah, but she had the spirit. She had the spirit of a matriarch.
No,
probably,
she doesn't.
You don't think so?
No, look how humiliated she is.
Even matriarchs have bad days. And that's an important point, right?
Yeah.
We're all human beings. Even Abraham and Sarai are human beings.
Look at what happened to the first Queen Elizabeth. You think about the queen and how humiliated she gets.
I don't know exactly.
I don't know my English history yeah. quite enough.
She had no children. She was never married. The first one.
And she was scorned by a lover. The whole thing is.
Uh-huh.
What did you say about Abraham and his treatment of Ishmael?
We're about to get to that. I hope. Verse 6.
But you want this point in time, you're basically abandoned.
We'll read those verses. We'll read those verses. Same chapter, verse 6. Avram said to Sarai, your maid is in your hands. Deal with her as you think right. What could Avram have said that he didn't say?
He said, well, not my fault. He
could have defended himself, right?
He could have, as we said before, and now, you know, told her that he loved her very
exactly.
much still. I mean, I don't care.
She is his wife, the other one is the maid.
Yeah, it's okay. It's going to work out.
Right.
Or, you are my wife, I love you, but we made this decision and we have to honor the decision. We can't
I
can
say it's God's will.
God. Make the best of it.
You will
but,
be in trouble with
but,
woman.
But you know.
Oh my goodness, Tony.
In verse 3, it establishes that Hagar is actually his wife. But here, Abraham goes back and says, she's your maidservant.
Exactly.
And that's exactly the tension here. She's a maid who's become a wife who's really a maid, and that's the fuel behind this whole inferno.
And she's exactly. the only one who is going to have a child right now.
Yeah. So the point is that in verse 6, when Avram finally speaks, he really doesn't speak on the level of a yes. husband talking to wife. He speaks,
no.
to use the words of Rabbi John Gray,
who's Rabbi John Gray?
He's the author of that famous Talmudic passage book, Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus.
Ah.
Rabbi John Gray would say here that Abraham has put on his Mr. Fix-It cap.
Yeah.
He's offering a solution,
mm-hmm.
but the problem is not physical, the problem is emotional. It's not do whatever you want with her, that's not going to help. It's in the heart, the issue. And there really isn't any emotional communication here between husband and wife.
Right.
And of course, we might be wrong to expect such a thing. This was 3,000 years ago. I don't know what went on.
No, because we have it with Elkanah and Hannah.
That's true. That's true. Right. Elkanah has two wives, and one of them is barren. And he says to the wife who's barren, don't worry, you're more to me than Seven sons, what it says, I think.
Ten, no?
You can look it up, the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. Okay, so Sarah treated her harshly and she ran away from her. And then God sends her back, etc. Okay, we're going through the sheets I prepared.
Ten.
We've already turned the page.
Ten
sons, thank you. Let's see. We are now going to go. All right. We're reading on verses 7 to 14. I'm just going too quickly. An angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, the spring on the road to Shur, and said, Hagar, slave of Sarai, where have you come from, and where are you going? And she said, I am running away from my mistress Sarai. And the angel of the Lord said to her, go back to your mistress and submit to her harsh treatment. And the angel of the Lord said to her, I'll greatly increase your offspring, and they shall be too many to count. The angel of the Lord said to her further, behold, you're with child, and you shall bear a son. You shall call him Ishmael. The Lord has paid heed to your suffering, etc. So, let me...
Behold, you're with child.
Like a surprise?
Didn't you just read several verses before? Everybody knows. That's the whole reason she ran.
I suppose he's not telling her you're going to have a child. He's saying the child you're going to have is to be called Ishmael. But I understand your point. I never thought of it.
Son.
But not
in
for
Hebrew,
now.
It's not, yeah. Behold.
What did it say in Hebrew?
Hinachara.
You're just pointing out the fact that
you're pregnant
and can have a child. But what I want to point out is the following. Here in verse 8, God, in the guise of this angel, what does he say? He says to her, where have you come from and where are you going? Now, he of course knows where she came from and where she's going. The angel opens up a conversation with Hagar. He talks to her. He allows her to speak her peace and to spill out her heart. I'm running away from Mistress Sarai, even though, of course, the angel knew that as well. What I'm trying to say is...
The angel does what Avraham should have done to Sarai.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. God is providing an example of talking to people who are in distress.
Shouldn't he be providing the example to Avraham?
Hagar is also in distress. Great distress. Mm-hmm. It's an example to us, I think. But let me go on a little bit. And what does the angel say in verse 11? You shall call him Yishmael, which means God hears. For the Lord has... And could you read the Hebrew there, Ilana? The end of verse 11?
Et el onyech.
The word before, the verb, Vayishma.
Kishama
Hashem El Onyech. God has heard your suffering. God has heard your suffering. Not seen, but heard. In other words, God has heard, God has listened. God has allowed you to express your suffering and listened. And the name of the child is the God who hears suffering. The God who lets the people who are suffering speak and God hears them.
That's what Yishmael means.
That's what the word means. Yishmael. Literally, God hears. But what does God hear? The suffering of the mother. So I would say that there might be a counterpoint here, a contrast between God's relationship to Hagar and Avram's relationship to
Sarah.
God knows how to hear and to take into account. Now, it doesn't say that God did anything about the suffering. He didn't do anything about the suffering. He said, go back and suffer more. Didn't do anything about it, but he listened to her.
Well, Abraham listened. It said Abraham listened to her.
No.
But he didn't speak.
He heard, but he didn't listen.
Well, Shema, it's same.
It's not a difference in the words, but Ilana's trying to say that he doesn't seem to have reacted to her pain on the emotional level, but rather just on the physical level of what are we going to do about it? It's getting very late. I want to look at the continuation of the story. So what happens? Hagar comes back. A child is born. Avram and Hagar, and to a certain degree Sarai, raise this child. He's now 1, he's now 5, he's now 10. And then when he's about 13, 12 or 13 or 14, Isaac is born. Let's read that now in chapter 21, verses 1 to 14. Chapter 21, verses 1 to 14, it's on the sheet, as everything else is. The Lord took note of Sarah as he had promised, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had spoken. Sarah conceived and bore a son to Avram in his old age at the set time which God had spoken. Avram gave his newborn son, whom Sarah had borne him, the name Yitzchak. When Yitzchak was 8 days old, Avram circumcised him, as God had commanded him. Now Avram was 100 years old when his son Yitzchak was born to him. Sarah said, God has brought me laughter, has brought me tzchok, Yitzchak, it's the same word. Everyone who hears will Yitzchak with me. And she added, who would have said to Avram that Sarah would suckle children and have born a son in his old age? The child grew up and was weaned. Avram held a great feast, and the day Yitzchak was weaned, Sarah saw the son whom Hagar the Egyptian had borne to Abraham playing. Mitzachek. Might mean mocking, it might mean doing evil things, it might mean just playing, it's not clear. Did she see something the child did that got her so angry, or did she simply see in the child a threat to her own child, who's really going to be the heir of Abraham? The new child is born, Yitzchak. And then she said to Avram in verse 10, cast out that slave woman and her son, for the son of that slave shall not share in the inheritance with my son Isaac. So now that she has her own, she wants to get rid of the one who she thought would be her own, Yishmael. We understand exactly what's happening on the emotional level. The matter distressed Avram greatly for concern the son of his, right? As far as he's concerned, Yishmael is as much his son as Yitzchak is. And what does Avram say when he's greatly distressed? The answer is nothing.
Nothing.
He's told, but God said to Abraham, do not be distressed over the boy or your slave. Whatever, Sarah.
Okay,
but that's after.
Okay, but what did Avram say immediately when the suggestion was made? Throw out this slave woman.
God help me. And God help them.
It could be immediately, but again, to apply the Talmudic exegesis of Rabbi John Gray here, Avram went into his cave and started thinking what to do. But did he say anything to Sarah?
No.
Perhaps not. So God said, do not be distressed over the boy, your slave. Bye. Whatever Sarah tells you, the Hebrew says, Shma Bikola. Shma Bikola, listen in her voice. It doesn't say listen to her voice, it says listen in her voice, literally. For it is through Isaac that offspring shall be continued to you. As for the son of the slave woman, make a nation of him too, he is your seed. Early next morning, Avram took some bread and the skin of water and gave them to Hagar. He placed them over her shoulder together with the child and sent her away, etc. Since time is late, I will just tell you. No, can we read something for 5 minutes?
Sure. Yeah.
Let's read the bottom of the page here. The bottom of the back. This is a woman, Marsha Pravda Merkin, in a book that's quite new.
Where?
Bottom of page two.
The bottom of the back side of the first page. The last line. By the time Isaac was born, Abraham already had 13 years to develop a relationship with Ishmael. Mm-hmm. Sarah, seeing the strong bond, worried that Ishmael would be Avram's heir along with Isaac. Driven by her fear and insecurity and unable to express her fears directly to a man who previously had been unable to listen to her, Sarah demanded of Abraham that he turn out Hagar and Ishmael. God intervened and told Avram to listen or hearken to Sarah's voice, Shma Bikola, and then promised to make nations of both his sons. Traditional interpretation takes these verses to imply that God meant Avram to obey Sarah and expel Ishmael. Such traditional interpretations often hear language through a patriarchal sensibility. However, a feminist understanding of this language creates a world of difference between listening to her voice and obeying. She's saying that Shema Likola, to listen to her voice, that means to obey. But listen in her voice might have a different meaning. Perhaps God wasn't saying to do
like,
what she...
Like to understand.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sarah was distraught.
Listen with your
she
heart.
She was lonely. Yeah. She was frightened. She needed Avraham to empathize with her feelings, to listen to her feelings. Sarah needed Avraham to sit there in empathy. She did not need him to take action, nor do we need to hear God's words as a request that Avraham take action. I believe God was saying, listen to Sarah, hear her feelings, be empathetic with Sarah. empathetic. Then let her know there's no reason to compete. There's room enough for both boys to grow up with my blessings. Avram instead acted. He didn't listen or question, but simply turned his son into the wilderness where he could die. After Sarah tells Abraham to cast out Hagar and Ishmael, we never hear another word from her. I imagine her a lonely, jealous, loving, wise, and sometimes short-sighted woman waking up the next morning and discovering that Hagar and Ishmael are gone, that Avram took literally the word she meant figuratively. I imagine her horror when she realized that her words led to the abandonment and possible death of a boy she had wanted for a son and the woman who served her for many years. I imagine that she felt so guilty that her words wronged others so severely, she vowed never again to hurt another with her words. Then she silenced herself.
Wow.
Powerful, powerful interpretation, which might not be the way it's been interpreted for 3,000 years, might not be exactly the pshat, but it might be very close to a new level of understanding that has affected my life deeply. And with this we'll close. It's only since I've been in Dallas that I've been introduced to a new generation of Bible commentary written by women, the first time in Jewish life that women have written Bible commentary. I brought here for you this one. I also brought in the rest of the sheets from Naomi Rosenblatt, a psychoanalyst in Washington. And these women is a in addition to Vanessa Oakes, who teaches at the University of Virginia, have introduced me in the past few years to a world of understanding that perhaps has been waiting to be uncovered, waiting to be discovered, and now it's available to us as a result of the bringing of women into the orbit of Torah study and Torah interpretation.
So Sarah never speaks again, right?
I mean, that's what she says, and apparently it's true. She never speaks again.
As far as the Torah, she never says another word.
And she dies right after the Akedah.
Yeah.
And she's off stage during the Akedah.
Mm-hmm. And then Abraham supposedly goes back to Hagar.
And takes many other wives after the Akedah.
Wow.
She was broken by her faithlessness in the end.
I don't think it's an issue of faithlessness. Why do you always emphasize faith?
Because you could also say the opposite. You could say she was broken by her faith. That her faith is what caused her to give Abraham Hagar. Because she had faith that God's promise had to be fulfilled.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Maybe God should have been a little more explicit with Abraham.
There's a lot of gray.
He was getting the message.
It's not that important.
And that's life. There's a lot of great. Jim wants to add something.
Sarah did speak to herself.
Where are you?
On 18:12.
So that's that's early. That's before chapter 21.
All right, you're right.
Before chapter 21.
So what do you say about
keeping
the
Holocaust? Okay, Shavuot Tov.
Skip that whole little piece about God's prediction.